"Yea, verily, and greetings to you all," he said in his very voice, and came close up to them. "It is indeed I. I am come for our father's sake on Hulda the she-ass to look after things with you, and to—" He stopped, disconcerted. They sat without word or stir and stared, a sinister group, like men bewitched. But as they so sat, although there was no sunrise and no sunset which might have painted their faces, yet these grew red as the twisted trunks of the trees at their backs, red as the desert, dark red as the star in the sky, and their eyes looked as though blood would spurt out. He stepped back. There arose and swelled a thunderous roar, that bull's roar of the twins, which made one's inwards to quake, and with a long-drawn shriek, as from tortured gullets, a furiously exultant yell of rage and hate and sudden release, they all ten sprang up as one man and flung themselves savagely upon him. They fell upon him as the pack of hungry wolves falls upon the prey. Their blood-blinded lust knew no pause or consideration. It was as though they would tear him into 14 pieces at least. Rending, tearing apart, tearing off, upon that they were bent to their very marrow. "Down! Down! Down!" they panted with one voice. It was the ketonet they meant, the picture robe, the veil. It must come off, and that was not so easy, for it was wound about him and fastened at head and shoulder. And they were too many for the deed. They got in each other's way. One thrust another away from the victim as he flew and fell and bounded among them. The blows meant for him showered upon themselves, though he indeed received a plenty as well. His nose bled almost at once, and one eye was closed with a great blue wheal. But the confusion served Reuben's ends, as he towered among them, shrieking, "Down, down!" with the rest. He used the immemorial tactics of those who wish to control a savage mob and keep a grip upon the course of events. He took part with apparent zeal in the fray, in order to prevent the worst from coming to pass. He dealt out blows while feigning to receive them, all the while cuffing and pushing those nearest Joseph, protecting him as best he might when they were about to strike him and tear off his robe. He aimed particularly at Levi, on account of the crook in his hands, blundering against it as often as he could. But despite all Reuben's maneuvers, Joseph was served worse than the petted youth could ever have dreamed possible. He reeled, half-dazed, with his head drawn down between his shoulders, and his elbows spread against the hailstorm of brutality descending out of a blue sky, which horribly seemed not to care where it struck, but beat down upon him, cutting into very little pieces his trust, his whole notion of the world, his conviction that everybody must love him more than themselves, as though it were a law of nature. "Brothers," he stammered, with the blood streaming down his chin from his nose and his bruised lips. "What are you?" A rude blow, which Reuben failed to fend off, knocked the words from his mouth. Another, landing in the pit of the stomach between the ribs, made him collapse and disappear beneath the pack. I cannot deny, rather I must emphatically say, that this uprising of the sons of Jacob, however much justice they had on their side, was a most shameful relapse into savagery. They sank below the level of the human, and availed themselves of their teeth, being otherwise busy with their hands, to tear his mother's garment from the body of the bleeding, reeling lad. They were not dumb at the work. They said other things besides down, down, down. They were like laborers pulling and heaving, and with monotonous cries subduing themselves to the common task, bringing up broken words out of the depths of their hate to feed their rage and stave off thought. Bow down, thou sayest. Look after things, wilt thou, thou thorn in the flesh, thou lingering sickness? There for thy dreams! And their unhappy victim, to him, the most horrible and incredible thing of all, was what happened to the ketonet. That was worse, crueler even, than all this howling horror about him. Desperately he tried to protect the garment, and keep the remnants and ruins of it still upon him. Several times he cried out, "My coat! My coat!" and even after he stood naked, still begged them like a girl to spare it. Yes, he was naked, for the violence of the brothers' onslaught not only carried off the veil, but but shift, loincloth, and myrtle wreath lay in tatters beside it on the moss, while blows rained down upon his naked flesh, and he sought as best he could to ward them off with his arms. "Bow down! Bow down! Take that for thy dreams!" Big Reuben did what he could to keep them off by behaving as though the others prevented him from coming at the victim and dealing his blows. "Thou thorn in the flesh! Thou lingering sickness!" he cried out with the rest. But also he cried out something else, which occurred to him on the spur of the moment, cried it loud and repeatedly, in order that they might all hear it and be guided in their blind rage. "Bind him! Bind him! Tie his hands and feet!" It was a new suggestion, invented in haste to a good end, namely, to set a definite goal to this otherwise incalculable business and introduce a breathing space, in the which Big Reuben, as he feverishly prayed, might avert the worst. They would not strike Joseph while they were busy binding him, and when he lay bound, that would be a temporary gratification, a stage at which they might stand off and consider what next. Such was Reuben's hasty calculation, and thus with desperate zeal he proposed his expedient, as though he were indicating the one and only useful and reasonable plan, and as though anyone was a fool who did not hearken to it. "There! That for thy dreams!" he shrieked. "Bind him! Bind him, you fools! What a senseless revenge! Instead of hitting me, bind him! Is there no rope?" he cried once more with all his strength. "Yes, Gadiel, for one, wore a length round his waist, and he took it off. As their heads were empty, there was room in them for Reuben's words. They bound the naked lad, bound his arms and legs with one long piece of cord, trussed him up properly while he moaned and groaned, and Reuben assisted zealously at the work. When it was done, he stepped back and wiped off his sweat with a gasp, as if he had worked harder than any. The others stood there, their lust for battle slaked for the present, panting, inactive, dazed. Before them lay Rachel's son, in grievous state. He lay on his bound arms, with the back of his head buried in the grass, his knees drawn up stiffly, his ribs going in and out, all bludgeoned. Moss and dirt clung to his body. It was slobbered with the foam of his brother's fury, and across it ran in winding streams the red juice which gushes out of beauty when its surface is marred. His undamaged eye now gazed terror-struck at his murderers, now closed spasmodically in a reflex action against fresh violence. The evildoers stood getting their wind. They exaggerated their breathlessness in order to cover the lack of counsel, of which, as reason returned, they were slowly aware. They, like Reuben, wiped off their sweat with the backs of their hands. They puffed out their lips and made faces expressive of justified revenge, as who should say, "Whatever we have done, can any reproach us for it?" They said the same in words. They panted out words justifying themselves in each other's eyes or before any court in the world. "Cuckoo! Thorn in the flesh! But we have shown him! We have cast him out! Could one credit it? Cometh here, here, before us, in his coat, before our eyes, to look after things. But we've looked after them, so he'll not forget it." And all the while, there was stirring within them a horror and shuddering, which all their words were meant to quiet. And if the horror and shuddering were looked at nearly, it would turn out to be the thought of Jacob. Great God! What had they done with the father's lamb? To what state had they brought the youthful heir of the departed Rachel? How would the master of words behave when he knew or learned it? How would they stand before him? And what would happen to them? Reuben thought of Bilhah. Simeon and Levi thought of Shechem, and of Jacob's wrath, and how he had come down upon them when they returned from their heroic deeds. Naphtali especially, found it a present consolation that Jacob was 5 days away and entirely unsuspecting. Yes, for the first time Naphtali realized as a blessing the power of space which separates and spares. But they all realized that the blessing could not be preserved. Jacob must presently hear all. When Joseph came again before his eyes, the storm of emotion, the rolling thunder of his words, the flashing lightning of his curses. The brethren could not escape nor yet endure them. Grown men as they were frightened like children, possessed with the fear of the curse in itself, and in all its meaning and consequence. Cursed they would be, one and all, because they had raised their hand against the Lamb. And now the young hypocrite would definitely be exalted above them as the chosen heir. They would actually have themselves to thank for the fulfillment of those shameful dreams. Precisely that which God willed would have been brought about by this accomplished fact. They perceived that Big Reuben had made fools of them with his advice. Here they stood, and there lay the thief of the blessing. Pretty well punished, indeed, and bound. But was that really an accomplished fact? It would be different if Joseph never did come before his father's eyes again, if something final and conclusive happened to him. The calamity and the lamentation would be even greater, of course, too great to think on. But, somehow or other, it would pass. Stopping halfway, even so they were guilty. If they went on, they needed not to be. All this went through their heads as they stood. Through Reuben's, too. He could not help recognizing the situation. He had brought the brawl to a halt with a shrewdness which came from his heart, but his reason told him that too much had happened for it to stop there. That more had to happen, and yet on no account, and at no price, must happen. This it was which made him giddy. Big Reuben's sinewy features had never before worn that baffled, sullen look. Each moment he feared they would voice the inevitable, and he had no answer. Then they voiced it, and he heard. One of them said, no matter who, since they must all be thinking the same thing, "He must away." "Away," nodded Reuben with grim confirmation. "Thou sayest it, but thou sayest not where." "Away altogether," answered the voice. "He must go down to the pit and be no more. Long time he ought not to have been. Now certainly he must be no more." "I agree," responded Reuben with bitter scorn. "And then come we before Jacob, his father, without him. Where is the boy?" he will ask. "He is no more," we answer. But if he ask, "Why is he no more?" then we answer, "We have killed him." They were silent. "No," said Dan, "not so. Brothers, hear me. I'm called Serpent and Adder, and a certain subtlety is not to be denied me. Thus we will do. We will put him in the pit, down in the dry well here, half-choked, in which is no water. There lieth he in safety and put away, and we'll see what his dreams bring him to. But before Jacob we must lie and speak with assurance. We have not seen him, and know not whether he still is or is not. If not, then in any case a ravening beast hath devoured him. Oh, woe, alas!" We must add, "Oh, woe," for the sake of the lie. "Be quiet," said Naphtali. "He lieth close at hand and heareth us." "No matter," answered Dan. "He will tell no one. That he heareth it is one reason more that he may not go from here. Even before that he could not, but now everything goeth together. We can speak as we like before him, for he is already as good as dead." A cry came from Joseph. He wailed out of his breast, stretched taut under his bonds, on which the tender red nipples stood out. He wept. "Can you hear it and not pity?" Reuben asked. "Of what avail is that, Reuben?" answered him Judah. "And what talkest thou of pity, though the rest of us may feel it as well as thou? Doth his weeping in this hour blot it out that he hath been a shameless toad all his days, and stank to heaven, and hath supplanted us with the Father with most shameless guile? Doth pity avail against necessity? And is it a good reason why he should go from hence and tell all? What good to talk of pity, even if it be felt? Hath he not already heard how we shall lie before Jacob? That is enough to end his life, that he hath heard it, and whether with or without pity Dan spoke the truth. He is as good as dead.
Thou art right, said Reuben then.
Let us throw him in the pit.
Again Joseph wailed piteously.
But he still weepeth, one of them reminded them.
Must he then not even weep? Cried Reuben. Let him go weeping into the pit. What more can you ask?